Brad, I was in the background kind of watching a medical show as I was drawing the other day. And they said, you know, we need 20 cc's of blood stat. And I realized that I have no idea what stat means as a word in English.
Well, that's, you don't know what that means? That's very simple. That means that it, when they say stat, you are supposed to come up with whatever sports-related statistic you can think of and shout it out so that you can distract them a little bit and keep them calm. Like, for example, you'd say in 1975, Joe DiMaggio had a 325 batting average, and that would help them to center and stay calm. So that's what that's all about, is you've got to yell out a statistic.
The surgeon's just like, I'm having a lot of trouble here, stat. Well, I got to tell you, Bernie Koufax his on-base batting average was amazing for but like, break it down. I don't know what stat comes from. Is it a military term? Is that what it is? Is it like statistical? Is it a short for statistical something? I don't know. I don't know what that means.
It comes from the Latin word statim, which means instantly. Didn't you take Latin in school?
I did. It's funny you should say that. I actually did take just a semester of Latin, which gives me seven words of which I don't use ever. Yeah. So statim is the word.
Statim.
All right. You know what I didn't do? I didn't use the old Google.com.
Well, that's what I just did.
I got to tell you, Brad, if you ever need to Google something, try Bing.com.
That actually, back in my newspaper days, this is interesting. And this is one I don't know what it comes from, but it's probably a Latin root as well. If a copy editor made a correction on a printout, you know, like we'd print out a story or a graphic, they would make corrections, write them up, and then hand it back. We'd make the corrections that they suggested. And if they made a correction and then found out that they wanted to remove the correction and keep it the way it originally was, the notation for that was stet, S-T-E-T. And that means ignore this correction.
Right. And I'll tell you how I know that. I actually worked as a proofreader for a year and a half out of college. Oh, boy, what an exciting job that was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's it. I developed a very, I don't want to say love-hate relationship, but working with copy editors, they are the most fantastic people you'll ever meet. But they are also the most, they are very hyper-focused on one thing. And when you're talking to someone like us cartoonists, I'm sure. But when you're talking to somebody like that, it's really fascinating to me because I like talking to people who are passionate about one thing. And you get them talking about something like the Oxford comma. or you know, whether a certain word should be hyphenated or not, and just they just get passionate about it. It's fantastic to see.
So I was the junior proofreader on staff, and the two older proofreaders had been there for 20 years. And I got to tell you, something about focusing on proofreading for 20 years, it becomes like a beautiful mind scenario. They were, socially, they were different people.
Yes.
You didn't want to go out for a beer with these 20-year proofreaders. They were...
No, you never get past the menu. Look at this. They've got lactose-free, unhyphenated. Let's leave.
Who did this kerning? And look at this double use of the ampersand. What is that? So anyway, I don't know how we fell into that rat hole. But anyway, proofreaders, not great on the Tinder dating scene, I got to tell you.
No.
That's the short version of that. One of our listeners is a professional proofreader and silently crying right now.
Swiping left all the way.
Anyway, hi, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, it's another month here on Patreon. All of our patrons have stuck with us for another month. generous souls that they are. And we've got a whole new batch of $5 level questions that I think there's some really good topics here. And I think we should just kind of do one of those shows where we start knocking off questions one after another. What do you think?
Bitty body boom. Let's start knocking off some questions. All right. So here's a question. How to recuperate after a failed con? It's been weeks and I'm still dumbfounded at my experience. I've done cons before, so I know what my numbers should be, including my average transaction. On one hand, I know it was a bad location. On the other hand, I want to try and prove that theory. Let me know your thoughts and story on this one. So, Brad, you have a delightful mix of memories about Comic-Cons. Tell me what your reaction is to this question.
Listen, if you've heard me talking about the gambler's mentality of Comic-Con, this letter sums it up perfectly. This is a person going through the gambler mentality of Comic-Con. I know what my number one, there's some dead giveaways. Number one, bad location. It's not that comic conventions in general are bad. I just got a bad location. Or the other perennial favorite, bad floor plan. Right. I don't know why they laid out that show this way. It wasn't good for anybody. It was a bad floor plan. Bad day on the calendar. Bad this, bad that. There's 101 excuses that a show doesn't go good. But here's the other end of that equation that makes it gambler's mentality. On the other hand, I want to prove my theory that I should have been at a higher number. I want to prove that this was a one-time thing, that I'm going to come back from it, that my next show isn't going to be bad. And then if your next show is bad, then you're going to want to prove it in the next show and the next show. And you're going to keep chasing that dragon, trying to even up your losses. And the more you go, of course, the more in the hole you get. And that's where you get the inherent problems with gambling. My advice is that you've got to take a really hard look at whether conventions in general are panning out for you, whether you're doing well at them. And my advice is to caution you against that whole idea where you try to prove that the next one's going to be better and that this was just a bad floor plan, that this was just, there are bigger economics at work than just the floor plan. And I would urge caution. What are your thoughts, Dave?
So my immediate thought is that I should just leave it where your answer lies. Like, I think your answer is probably the best summary of it. But for the sake of discussion,
yeah,
I have had shows where I did the same show for 5 years and all of a sudden they moved me to a weird corner. And boy, it is true that a different location can just drop your sales through the floor. Mm-hmm. So that is a possibility. But broadly speaking, I think you are 100% correct. I think it's a gambler's mentality. I think you are chasing that dragon of maybe even an illusory outcome that will never come. It's hard because the desire to make a Comic-Con work, especially if everything else is right, if the logistics of a show are great for you, if the timing is on the calendar is great for you for your work year, if the friends that you see at a show are great, sometimes it's hard to walk away from a show. But
yeah,
as Brad is saying, if the profit is not there, you are stepping away from your desk, you're stepping away from your friends and family, you're stepping away from your routine, all to lose money. And there better be some good reasons more than, I know I can do better at this show.
Yeah.
So it's really, unless a show pays for you, and for me personally, I've winnowed it down to two shows from 15 across the U.S. Unless those shows work for you, you really got to cut them out. And as we've said a lot of times on this show, frankly, the easier economics of being able to do something online with either Patreon or Kickstarter or eBay or your own site, your own store, you can save yourself a lot of trouble and no longer have to go to conventions in a way that you might have around the turn of the century. So
yeah.
I think you could maybe dodge a bullet by taking the show off your calendar for next year.
Yeah. Well, and also think about that is that if you can be derailed that easily by something like floor placement, then you've got, number one, then that's the very definition of a gamble, right? If you're putting money up And something like floor placement can completely wipe out your investment. That's the definition of a gamble. So either you need to do whatever you can to mitigate that risk, or decide not to take the risk in the first place, that it's too much of a risk to take. How do you mitigate that risk? I don't know. In certain cases, like Dave, you're going to Comic-Con International in a couple of weeks. Yes. Your risk is mitigated in that you know exactly where you're going to be on the floor. It's going to be the same floor that it's been every year since time immemorial. You know where you're going to be. You know who your neighbors are going to be. You know exactly what the layout you're getting into. That's a mitigated risk, right?
Right.
And so if you can't determine where you're going to be and what the overall, if you can't see what the overall landscape is going to be, then you've got to, I'm not saying that you necessarily need to say, well, I'm not going to do that because I can't see the floor plan, but you've got to understand that that's part of the risks that are going into putting up the money for this show.
Yeah. It's funny you should mention Comic-Con because there is a concern in the back of my mind because so many of my risks with San Diego Comic-Con are mitigated because for me, it's a drive down the coast. It's an hour and a half drive, right? So I can load up a van and drive down. I stay with family, so that cost is minimized.
Yeah.
And in general, San Diego is my home base because I grew up down there. So there's a lot of resources at my disposal, right?
Yeah.
But even then, there are times where if I look over like a 5-year span where I go, am I a lobster in a slowly boiling pot? In the sense,
that's a great metaphor.
In the sense that I may not be realizing that the show is changing right underneath my feet. So I know all the variables that you have just said about it's the same show as last year. I'm in the same floor plan, all the, et cetera, right? But overall, if I look at it, I've been going to Comic-Con now for 20 years. And if I look at 5-year increments and 10-year increments, there are less cartoonists of my peer group directly and physically around me. And that does make a difference to my sales. And more emotionally, it makes a difference to my enjoyment of the show. So I'm cognizant of the fact that I've got to be keep an eye on that. That the show is a little bit changing under my feet into a much bigger media show.
Yeah.
And how that is impacting my sales and the way I have to react to the show. So that's just something that I'm keeping a tab on because I think I'll always do San Diego Comic-Con for all the factors I listed at the top. Mm-hmm. But it is a little bit changing underfoot for me. So
yeah. Well, because even with all those mitigating factors, it's still an awful, that show in particular is an awful long time away from your studio.
Oh, God, yeah. And it's an awful long time away from my family. It's an awful long, it's a big ask, you know, you can't, it's not something you do on a whim. Like I prepare for that sucker for, a couple weeks in the background of my work day. So, it's a big ask. But anyway, so, and it's still, listen, I want to to put it in context of our, as Brad would say, our question askers, our questioner's question, it is still something that makes me a profit. So that one I go to and still a big enough profit where it's worth going to resoundingly. But for you, having taken a loss at the show, I would just advise as a friend, cut that one from your schedule. I think by all means, explore another show. If there's another one in that region that you'd like to try. But don't keep putting money into the same slot machine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I think, and not only that, but realize that your decision to do that, it frees you up to do something else with that time. In other words, don't take that show off your calendar if you do decide to do that. Don't take that show off the calendar and just and sit at home that week and twiddle your thumbs. Focus on maybe doing a new micro project. You know, there's been this whole concept, and this is not a new thing. This is a couple of years old. The whole idea of like a micro Kickstarter, like something that you, a small project that you just kickstart for a week or 2 weeks and you do a micro project. Think about all of the different ways that you could use that time and prove to yourself that maybe there is a better use of your time. Now, if you do that and fall on your face, which is, again, that's all part of learning. That's all part of experience things. And you, and by all means, you should be embracing that opportunity, as weird as it is to hear, embracing failure. But if you do that and fall on your face, well, then next year you try something else. But the only problem I've got is when I see somebody coming back, and the only reason I've got a problem with it, because it reminds me so much of me, like going back to that same, it took a long time before I finally figured out that Wizard World Philadelphia, which I could walk to, was a bad investment in time, because I literally had zero investment. But standing there behind that table while people walked by or tumbleweeds blew through the aisles, even that was a bad investment of my time. And it took me a long time. I, like Dave said, I kept putting money into that same slot machine because I'd kid myself, well, it's right here in my backyard and I don't have to do any prep. It was still too much. So yeah. I just want to encourage you maybe to break out of that pattern and try something new.
Boy, there is no more damning break of a pattern than you being able to walk to a show and you're like, "Yep, it's no good for me."
Still not doing no it. Good. Yeah. And not only that, but again, gambler's mentality. There was years like I think 2010, 2011, when I made some serious money for me, for my relative to my conventions, probably some of my best years, even weighed against some of the golden years of San Diego. And great years at Emerald City. Some of my best years were at Philadelphia at that convention center. And then it got harder and harder to let go because I was sure that next year was going to be better. And that this year I was just a bad place on the floor. This year they had the five captains of Star Trek in and everybody spent all their money on photo ops. This year there was some other big stuff. Well, there's always going to be something. There's always going to be a reason you're not doing well at that convention. At some point, you've got to decide that maybe it ain't working for you. And that's not a death sentence. That's actually a life sentence to open up and do something different with your time.
Oh, my God. You have never sounded more like a Hallmark card. That's amazing. Brad, you've got to look at your challenges not as a death sentence, but as a life sentence.
Yes. I've never been more serious. People think, I'm giving up. I'm a has-been. I'm a washout or a never was. it's not. There's other stuff to do.
I just love that particular phrasing. Hello, I'm Susan McTaggart, inspirational speaker. You've got to look at this challenge as not as a death sentence, but as a life sentence. Get my new book, Finding the Best You in You. All right, well, let's move on to our next $5 question, and I'll read it off to you. So, Brad and Dave, in a lot of your answers to people, you say good work is the key. If I want to fight making fear-based decisions and focus on good work, what should I be focused on learning and doing? Brad Geiger, I put that question to you, my friend.
Well, to a certain extent, this is an impossible question to answer because, and I really want you to pay attention to the overlying issue with this. The answer to that question is going to be different for every single cartoonist. One cartoonist comes up, I might say you need to focus on your writing. Another cartoonist comes up, I might say you need to focus on doing better on social media, or your art or your publishing calendar. There might be any number of things that I would want you to focus on when it comes to what you're asking about. However, I think there are some general issues. And for me, and I've talked about this before, for me, the number one thing is to focus on the comic in a very mindful way. In other words, when I say focus on the comic, I don't mean spend more time creating it. I mean spend more time not only in the creation of it, but in the reviewing of it and in the pre-production of it. First thing you can do is spend about 2 to 3 times more in the pre-writing process. In other words, don't take that first idea, don't take that first draft, rewrite it at least 1 or 2 times with significant rewrites. That's pretty close to universal. I think we could all take a little bit from that. But not only focusing on the comic itself, I want you to take a little bit of a step back and really monitor the time you're spending on social media. In other words, you can get onto social media to post that comic and post it on all of the major social media that you follow. You can take 5 or 10 minutes later on, like 6 hours later, to respond to any notifications, anything that's going on, people who have made positive comments. You can retweet or share or do whatever you can to amplify that. But the time that you're spending on social media is not helping you make good comics. And if you are making good comics, you don't need that much time on social media. That's gonna take care of itself. So my answer is twofold. Number one, spend more time writing, particularly, and working on the comic in general. And number two, spend less time screwing around and farting around on social media, distracting yourself from doing good comics. What do you think, Dave?
Well, I was hoping you would pull out one of your Susan McTaggart, Living a Better Life. Hello, I'm Susan McTaggart. Today we're going to talk about finding the better you by avoiding fear-based decisions.
Well, if you listen, Dave, if you fear the work, then your work will be fear.
That's a Susan McTaggart line. That's great. I'm going to laugh, by the way, Brad. Brad, I'm going to laugh if later on, if I'm Googling Susan McTaggart and it turns out there is an inspirational speaker named Susan McTaggart.
It certainly sounds like the perfect name for somebody doing that.
The one that always cracks me up as the perfect name for inspirational speakers is Zig Ziglar. And I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah,
Zig
no kidding.
Ziglar. Anyway, so fear-based decisions. Okay, so me, I want to focus less on the learning and more on the fear-based decisions and how to avoid a fear-based decision.
Ooh, okay.
So to me, as counterintuitive as it might sound, the opposite of fear is love. Now, hear me out on this.
Yeah.
Another way to say this is passion and excitement, right?
Yeah.
So if in your work, if you're like, oh, I should just color this in Photoshop, but God, I really want to watercolor this one, or the line work for this one, I want to not draw this in my normal style. I want to draw this in a 1950s style. Now, normally, a fear-based decision would be like, no, you're going to mess it up somehow. Don't do that. No one will like that weird change in style. Don't do that, or this and that. But if you love it and if you are passionate about it and if you feel in your heart of hearts that it's the right move, then that is the right move to make.
Yes.
And for all the reasons we always talk about, that passion will come through in the work, and your love for what you've created will translate into people loving that piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
And a really good example of that, and it's so funny that it popped into my mind, I haven't thought about him in forever, is Perry Bible Fellowship with Nick Gerwich. Mm-hmm. Brad, I'm sure you're familiar. But
no,
if you look through Nick's work, every third comic is drawn totally differently and it takes a completely different editorial slant and a completely different view, such that it's completely unexpected when the punchline hits. And to Nick's huge credit on that, you can see that he is not operating out of fear. He's operating out of, to hell with it. This is what I want to draw. I'm having fun drawing this. This is fun for me. Are you having fun too? Of course you are, because I'm having fun. And so one of the reasons why Perry Bible Fellowship is so infectious is because he clearly was not operating out of fear. He was just having fun with it, and the joy came through the work. So that's one way to look at fear. Another way to look at fear is to separate out fear-based decisions around money and fear-based decisions around creativity, because I will very strongly advocate for making manageable size failures when it comes to money, right? Like, you never want to be like, hi, I'm Susan McTaggart. I'm rolling the dice. Here's a $40,000 book run that I'm doing. We're having a lot of fun. Woo, I'm chasing my dream. So don't listen to Susan McTaggart when it comes to money. I think money is one where you do, as you build your career, you want to make mistakes. And one of the reasons why I always say manageable size mistakes, you want to make a mistake such that if the worst comes to pass, that the money will not become a Titanic for your career.
Right.
You know, you don't want to quit the day job where it's like, I'm rolling the dice and no one's going to stop me. And here we go. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. I need that money back. You want to make it where you're like, you're working on nights and weekends, because that's a more manageable size mistake money wise. So separate out fear-based decisions on money from creativity. Now, creativity, there's almost no way you can fail if the love and the passion and the joy are there. And so follow your heart. And if your heart is telling you that, you want to draw something completely different, or if you want to write a topic that you don't think anyone else might be interested in, but you're in, God, by God, you're interested in it. Yeah. I mean, look at Kate Beaton with history. Look at Zach Wienersmith with science. Look at, you can name a thousand.
Randall Monroe with math.
Yeah, look at Check Please in terms of a hockey player that loves to bake. I mean, yeah. You can think of any topic where it's like, there's no audience for this. No one will like this. But because they love it, boy, that comes through in the work. And so that's not fear-based decision-making in their cartooning. So creativity-wise, you almost can't... you can't operate enough in terms of being away from fear. Money-wise, all right, there you can have a little bit of fear trickle into your work, but yeah. And to your decision making. But anyway, so that's why I would advocate that love and passion is the opposite of, as Susan McTaggart would say, love is the opposite of fear, Brad.
You were talking about making manageable financial failures. Did I ever tell you about the only time I ever chased somebody down at a comic convention and made them? Made them allow me to buy my book back from them?
No. What this is guy, this story? This How do guy, I not know this story?
This guy comes up to me. He buys the webcomics handbook, right? And he's like, this is going to show me how to do webcomics. And I'm like, that book is going to talk about the business side of webcomics. It's going to talk about advertising, putting your stuff up on the web, promotion, crowdfunding, blah, blah, blah. And he says, that's great. That's exactly what I need. I'll take it. I sold him the book, and we're talking for a short while afterwards. And he says, well, listen, this book really better be good. And I said, well, I'm very proud of it. I think it's very comprehensive. He says, no, it's got to be good, because next week I get my final unemployment check. And I'm going to this website up over the weekend. And he hadn't even started working on a comic strip yet. He goes, I'm going to put my website up over the weekend, and I've got some ideas for a comic strip, and this book has got to do it. And he walked away, and I literally practically jumped over the table, ran down the aisle, and I stopped him, and I said, listen, come back to my table. And I said, listen, here's the deal. This is a bad idea. It's such a bad idea. I want you to give me the book back. I'm going to give you the money back. You need to put that money. If your last unemployment check is next week, you need that money for something way more important than this book. You can get this book at the library. You can find this book online. I even told him there's some places that you can find that book pirated online. Do a couple searches. I won't begrudge you of that. Don't buy this book. It's the worst idea you possibly could have. What you're talking about takes years and years and years to build. You're not going to build it in a weekend. You need to really use this on food. Use this on something way more. Pay your electric bill. Do whatever you got to do, but don't buy this book and think you're going to start a webcomic and you're going to start bringing in money next week. It just isn't going to happen.
Oh God, that's terrifying. Well, Brad, yeah. Normally our sales at Comic Cons are like the lowest stakes ever. It's like, well, yeah. I hope I enjoy this. Have a good day. And this guy's like, well, I hope this cures my sciatica. Otherwise, I've got to have the operation.
Yeah, and I didn't want that on my conscience. You know, I could not have let that guy walk away. I would have been obsessing over him for the next several months, if not years. I wonder if that guy ever did anything, you know?
Oh God.
And that...
That's and all then, the talk about fear-based decision making. That's all the wrong ways to make a comic. It's like you're under a deadline, right?
Yeah.
Money is short and has to come in immediately. And also, money considerations came before creativity decisions. That's all the worst conditions.
And he didn't even have a comic yet. He just had an idea for a comic.
So that, in terms of answering our question, asker, that is exactly what a fear-based decision looks like. So for you, because you talked about you wanted to focus on learning the right way to be creating. And the truth is that like any enjoyable activity, if there's joy in your art, then I guarantee you are learning as you're drawing. Hand is figuring out new techniques. If you're drawing every day, as Brad always says, and frankly enjoying it, then that's not operating from fear. But as Brad said, also focus on removing negativity, removing the social media feed, you know, try to minimize it in your life. And frankly, there is a really great way to focus on the goods in comics, and that is just to read good comics. Flipping through a Calvin and Hobbes for art, or flipping through, a saga for good writing, or, I don't know. I'm trying to think of good examples there, but, that it influences your making good decisions in your own art. So, in addition to focusing on the joy and the passion and the creativity in your own work, surround yourself with good stuff and less on the negativities and the stupidities of social media. So
yeah, that's something I've been meaning to bring up, because it's a thread I noticed listening to the old shows. Zach Wiener-Smith and Scott Kurtz and Danielle Crosetto. Think about all the people that not only we've had on the show, but people that you and I have met in real life who are who we consider kind of top flight, really cartoonists that we admire. What's the one thing that they all have in common? They all are voracious readers.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean? Think of how well read most of the cartoonists that we admire are. These are people that are constantly feeding their brains with stuff, constantly doing intake, constantly indulging in their passion of comics, and not only comics but good writing in general. It's a common thread among almost all of these people that they're very well read.
Yeah.
So don't think for a second that that's wasted time, the time that you might spend with a good book. That's feeding your creative soul kind of stuff.
Well, and as Brad's alter ego, Susan McTaggart, would say, a book is a friend you carry with you. I don't know how I've gotten. By the way, Susan McTaggart absolutely is on Marriage Number 4. She's currently polishing off a bottle of Chablis and on Marriage Number 4. But she's sitting there going, when you chase your dreams, you chase your future.
And as Groucho Marx once said, outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. And inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. You ruined my punchline.
Oh, all right. Well, so Bradley J, we got a question just for Brad. Do you want me to read this one to you, my friend?
Yeah.
Hi, guys. This is one more for Brad, but I'm sure Dave will have some good insights. Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah, I want to hear your insights.
Brad, when you decided to take the plunge into not suitable for work comics, how did you navigate perceptions with your family, wife and young sons, friends and colleagues? Did you get any puritanical grief? Also, any recommendations for someone considering this route? Anything you would have done differently? Oh. So, Brad, this is a question that I can chime in almost not at all. I have to say, as a friend, even though I think we talked about it at the time you made the move, I would love to hear your answers to this, because this was a big change for you going from Evil Inc., which was a comic strip, as you always pitched it, about supervillains running a corporation.
Yeah.
Into a not suitable for work sideline from those same characters. So let's jump into that first question first. How did you navigate perceptions with your family, your friends, and your colleagues? Did you get any puritanical grief when you made this move?
The answer is knock on wood, no.
Don't say knock on wood in the context of this question.
Well... Boy, how did I miss that? You sure you don't want to write for this? So far, I've been very lucky. My wife is 100% behind it. She's all for it. She's got zero problems. It is funny because people won't come to me directly and say anything, but like they'll come up to her and they'll say, "Are you okay with this?" And then of course she looks at him and says, "Yeah. It's going great. It's fantastic. And by the way, sex is nothing to be ashamed of. Sex is something everybody does. Sex is something everybody likes." And she reminds them that the stuff that I do is always focuses on stories that feature stuff like consent and kind of positive outlooks on this topic. And the way that I've talked about it in the past is that, to be honest with you, I'd rather be doing something like this than something where somebody, you know, is shooting guns at people or, you know, slicing their hands off with a sword and stuff like that. I find that to be violence is shameful. Violence is something to be ashamed of. Sex is nothing to be ashamed of. And so therefore, if I really believe that, then stories that that center on that are also valid. And so that's kind of the guiding principle that I've taken throughout this. And when my older son started to, you know, his friends started Googling me, and this became a topic, that's kind of the talk that I had with him too. And as I said, you know, there's nothing wrong with stories that center on this kind of topic. Violence, on the other hand, is something that you should be treating with a little bit more care in storytelling. And I made no bones about it. We went to see the second Deadpool movie together, and that was another opportunity to say, take a look at all of the glorified violence there was in that, and what is that saying? What are we signing off on? On that, do we need that level of violence to tell a good story? That's something that has opened up, especially as my kids become teenagers, knowing that they can talk about these issues and there's no shame that's involved in that. I think, or at least I hope, will be helpful moving forward. It is not now. I've done numerous teaching opportunities. I'll be teaching again this fall, and I made everybody in terms of my superiors at the college, I made them very aware of what I do, and it has not been a problem. So far, this has been not a big issue that has held me back by people being puritanical, as you put it. However, that's I'm also realistic. That is going to come at some point. There is going to be a certain amount of pushback at some point. And the only difference that I second guess myself on a pretty regular basis is not using a pen name. And I struggled with that for a long time. I think it would have been easier if I would have come up with a pen name for that. I could have very easily done a wink and a nod tuple sort of thing and made people understand that when they were supporting this other person, they were actually supporting me. I think I could have made that very obvious. But
right. But so. There's been, you grew up in a small to mid-sized town in the Midwest, and I have some small experience with small to mid-sized towns in the Midwest. Yeah. And so you haven't had any pushback family-wise or like, well, Brad, that kind of.
So far, no, my parents are unaware of it. But then again, they didn't follow Evil Inc. A lot. You know, they weren't really checking in on that stuff. They had all of the graphic novels displayed at the house. And my wife tells me that it's probably the most poorly kept secret in the family. But so far, it's kind of been something that nobody's brought up to that extent. So no, I haven't. I haven't gotten like an email from anybody. And again, I'm very, because I refuse to go along with this whole idea that it's shameful. I put that stuff out pretty liberally, right? I don't make a whole lot of bones about what I do. But so far I haven't gotten like an old high school friend that says, you're a real creep or, you know, something
right.
like that.
Right.
So far it's been pretty good. And
well, I have a lot of roads that I want to walk down with you on this topic.
Yeah.
And I definitely want to jump into the American versus the European versus the Japanese tradition of what we should be shameful of.
Yeah.
So I do want to circle back around on this, but I have one thing I want to talk about more than anything else in the context of family and puritanical grief and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
In a previous show, you had told, I think it was Lucy Bellwood and I, about Uncle Elmer, who lived on the farm and who had wanted you to take over the dairy business and said... He had said, well, are you going to be a cartoonist for your whole life? And you said, yep, that's what I'm going to do. Well,
yeah,
all right. And turned away and walked away, right?
Yeah, with the same expression that if I would have told him that the cancer was malignant.
Right. So here's my friend challenge of the week. Da-da-da-da. I want you to take one of your printed editions of your Not Suitable for Work comics. Next time you fly home to Michigan, I want you to go out to Uncle Elmer's farm, his dairy farm. Be like, hey, Uncle Elmer, I brought you something to show you what I'm working on. And I just want to know the full context of how Uncle Elmer responds to that.
Yeah, that's a challenge that I'm never going to accept. I might take him courting disaster, but I am not taking Evil Inc. After Dark.
I love the idea because we were talking last week about my father-in-law of kind of like looking at me going like, this is an honest day's work. Like, what do you do? You're drawing all day. I would love the idea of your Uncle Elmer realizing that this is what you do for a living.
Yeah, that you know what, he might actually I might grow in his estimation after that. He might have an appreciation for that. I'm not sure.
Right. Okay, so that's one venue I want to talk about. The second one I want to talk about is, I'm so glad that you hit on violence as the counterpoint, because American puritanical America from a long tradition of religious endorsement or unendorsement has this thing with violence is perfectly acceptable and sex is the worst thing to be shameful of. Whereas Europe is the exact opposite. And I find this fascinating, where probably as a result of World War II, violence is the one to be shunned and sex is totally fine. And then what's funny is Japanese, by contrast, in their comics, both sex and violence are fine for storytelling, but God forbid you spill some milk in a school cafeteria, because that is so embarrassing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. To me,
it's so funny how the Japanese, who are a wonderful people, the worst thing in a comic is just to have been embarrassed. Like, just anything but being embarrassed. Don't let me get embarrassed for anything.
Don't let me get humiliated. Well, and since I've been doing this more and more, so of course I'm checking out, you know, so I am looking at how Europeans do adult comics. I'm looking at how, you know, Japanese, you know, they've got a whole genre of adult comics, and I'm looking at how they treat those subjects. And it's really interesting. Some of the European comics are super, super, like really into BDSM, like really like tough stuff. Like the people don't, here's my problem, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to. A lot of the comics in this genre that I see, the people don't look like they're having fun. And that bugs me. And I don't know whether you were familiar with Phil Folio's Xenophile, the adult series that he did back in the day.
You know what? I know Phil, and I know of that title. I don't know that I've ever actually seen that title.
Oh, and the thing that really brought me to this was Patreon, right? As I've said in the past, this was something that my readers were telling me in no uncertain terms that this was what they wanted. This was something that when I offered it as a proof of concept, I put one strip up, four panels, and my Patreon tripled by the end of the month. And it was like you don't get a more clear indication from your audience about what they want. And that's why I always tell people, you don't necessarily need to go into NSFW work for Patreon. What you do need to do is find what your readers are willing to pay for and do that thing. Right. Listen to your readers. And this was not the first thing that I'd put out. This was Go ahead.
Even before, I don't want people to chase money purely. And because I also know that that's not what you did. It's not just a pure money chase. You also had a passion for it and an interest for it. So it grew out of that, too.
Like, absolutely. Right? But here's my point. It was something that that my readers were responding to very strongly. OK. It was a way for my readers to say, this is something that we want. And as a creator, you've got to kind of listen to that a little bit. You've got to play to your home crowd. You dance with the one that brought you. And it was a way for me to kind of, it was a way for me to see that this was a viable thing that I probably wouldn't have gone to otherwise.
Right.
It was not an idea that I would have been felt free enough to have pursued without my readers saying, no, we got your back on this. This is something. And when I started building this audience, I got to tell you, I've never had a more supportive, amazing readership than when I started building this base. It's been a really phenomenal experience for me. But what I wanted to bring up for with Phil is that when this transition was happening, I went back and I read his Xenophile books, and I talked to Phil just before I started doing it at New York Comic Con, the last time I went to New York Comic Con, and we sat down in an Indian restaurant and had a long, long talk where he addressed some of my fears, gave me some really good advice. It was a really one of those nights that was kind of transformative when somebody with a little bit of experience takes the time to really kind of walk you through something. And that was the thing about Phil's comics that he did, the Xenophile comics. Everybody was always enjoying their experience. Everybody was having fun. It was a joyful look at sex and in a creative, inventive way of, you know, it wasn't just these two people get naked and then crazy stuff happens. It was you know, what happens if an alien, you know, comes down from outer space? What happens if a mythical creature is introduced? What happens at sex in outer space? It was science fiction, fantasy, and it raised the storytelling to such a point because it was a look at this activity that in a way that you never thought of before. And so he pumped creativity into this thing. He put a lot of love into this thing and also a lot of joy. And it kind of showed me how this whole storytelling could be, and I keep coming back to that word, and I'm sorry, joyful. It was fun. People were happy and silly, and that would became my gold standard. It was like, if I can do stories like that, then I'll know that I will have succeeded.
Well, you don't need to apologize for joy being the hallmark of it. I mean, so much of our advice with cartooning is to never forget and never walk away from the joy that brought you to it in the first place.
Yeah.
So I completely. But also, you talking about Phil is a great time to transition to the second part of this question, which I think will be fascinating to hear your answer. Brad, looking back on how you did it, how you made this transition to not suitable for work comics. What a chewy acronym that is, by the way. Not suitable for work comics. What would you do differently looking back on it now? What aspects or steps did you take or not take that you were like, I wish I would have done it this way?
The only thing that I second guess myself, as I said a little bit earlier, the only thing that I second guess myself is not using a pen name. But the more I think about it, the more I think I would have also been disappointed in myself for using a pen name, because then it would have been saying, well, this isn't valid, or this, you know, there is shame in this. It would make things, it would take certain things off the table. Like when I go in to teach a class, it was funny. I talked to a guy that is a professor at this college that I'll be teaching at in the fall. And I said, you know, I told the director of the department, I said, you know, these kids are going to Google me and it's going to come up. And he laughed. He says, Brad, kids don't Google their professor anymore. That's 5 years ago. They don't Google anymore. He goes, I go and teach a class and I'll talk about things that I've done, and they have no idea about what I've done and what I've worked on. He says, that's something that we did 5 years ago. People aren't Googling their professors anymore. So that's something that it would take that issue off the table so that I don't ever worry about it. But at the same time, it would have been giving in on a philosophy that I think I would have been disappointed. So, and that's
in terms of not feeling shame, you mean?
Yeah. And the idea of using a pen name in general, I think I would have been disappointed myself if I would have used a pen name. It would have certainly made some things so that they're not even topics, you know, something I really don't have to worry about or could easily explain away. But I think I'd be disappointed in myself if I had done that. And I think if you look around, you see a lot more people going into this subject matter. For example, have you seen Danielle Corsetto's new comic that she's doing on Webtoons?
It's funny you should mention that. I just saw that yesterday that she was doing that one. Yeah.
And she's doing a, I gotta look it up because I want to make sure I get the title right. But she's doing a new cartoon.
We're gonna pause here to let Grandpa Google.
But, it's called Boo, It's Sex. And it's at Lion Webtoons. And it's basically these college-aged women that come into a sorority house type situation, and a ghost of a sorority girl's past guides them through understanding sex and relationships and their own bodies and so forth. Basically, it's a sex education comic that's done in a really interesting and creative and funny way. Danielle's writing it, and they're doing it exclusively for Webtoon. You see more and more people who are kind of embracing this topic. I think in another 5 years, it's going to be even less of a hush-hush kind of topic than it is now. I think we're getting more and more accepting of it as people in general. But I don't know that I do a lot differently than I'm doing it right now. I think the two things that I really think worked for me is, number one, owning it and saying this is a thing that I'm doing. If you're cool with it, that's great. And if not, I understand that too. You know, I have gotten I've been doing this since what, 2015. I've gotten two emails from people that were Evil Ink readers that said, I just don't like what's going on here. And I said, I get it. That's fine. I understand. It's not going to change. It's not going to stop. But I don't tell you that you should feel differently. In fact, because I feel like I've been talking an awful lot, I'm gonna bring in this one last anecdote, and then we'll move to another story. But one person was a $1 Patreon backer, so he was already backer at $1, and he wrote in to say, "I don't like when you're always advertising this stuff in a blog." And I said, "Hey, I got good news for you. You never have to come to my site. You're a $1 Patreon backer. You get the Evil Ink comic itself sent to you early through Patreon. So if you want to avoid the advertising I'm doing on my site, you can not go to my site ever again and still read the comic. And it's part of what you're already doing on Patreon." You know what he did?
What?
Canceled his pledge within 24 hours. Because
people are weird.
Because I was asking him for money. I said, no, I wasn't. I was telling you the money you're already spending is solving the problem that you wrote into me about. No, you're a money grubber and you shouldn't be asking for money. And I'm like, well, then that's fine. You always want to leave things on a good note. I said, well, I appreciate your past support, blah, blah. And never heard from him again. But it's like, there's nothing I can do about a reader like that.
That's amazing, Brad. That's like a supermarket cashier that's like, well, here's the candy bar for the dollar you bought. What are you asking me for a dollar for the candy bar? No, sir, you've already given me the dollar. This is the candy bar you get. Ah, you just want money from me. No, I took your dollar already. This is your candy bar.
And this is it was not his first month. He had been a $1 backer for a long time. And I'm like, I get it. I get that you don't want to see that. I get you don't want that coming up when you check the site out at work. Fine. You're already getting it through Patreon and you get nothing of the advertising there. You can get it right delivered right to your email. You already got it. You've got the answer to your problems. And what he wanted was not an answer to his problems. What he wanted was, for me to change my entire life because of his outlook. And that wasn't going to happen.
Let's put a button on this conversation, but with one thought, First, let me thank you for that, because that was really nice of you to talk us through your decision making and your history with making that move with Evil Link. So thank you for that. And then B, I also want to just a doff of the cap to Danielle Corsetto, because the title Boo It's Sex is amazing.
Isn't that wonderful?
I am very big on monosyllabic titles in terms of how quickly you can communicate the title, you know?
Yeah.
And also, that tells you everything you need to know about the goofiness of the comic, the joy of it, and also the subject matter. Boo, it's sex. In three syllables, she got the whole title. And that's amazing. Like, literally, doff of the cap to her on that.
Yeah, and do check it out. Danielle's writing it. Monica Gallagher is illustrating it, and the illustrations are charming. Here's the other reason. Even if you're not interested in a sex advice comic, check out how they're displaying it on Webtoons. It's all built for the scroll. This is a comic that is completely built to be read on a mobile device, and it's everything that we've been talking about in terms of adapting for mobile. It's not built for a page. It's built for a scroll. And there's some aspects of that I'm not sure how I feel about. But since this is being created specifically for Webtoons, I think there's something instructive in how they're doing it there that a lot of our readers, or our listeners rather, might be interested in. So other reason, look at what they're doing there. It's interesting.
Yeah, given the targeted age group and interest levels, that's a perfect match of aiming it for the utes and execution. So that, I think that, anyway, doff of the cap to her and to the whole team on that. I'm excited for her to get going on that. All right, so let's do one last question to button up the week. This is our last $5 question, and I think it's interesting. So it's about an artist transitioning into comics and some specific questions for us. So, Dave and Brad, I've been drawing since I was a kid, but I'm new to the whole comics format, and I'm a little overwhelmed by some of the technical aspects of how putting work online, not so much the actual how, but more of the best practices. So one of my most basic questions is just regarding size. How big or small do you guys draw? If you're drawing on paper, how much do you put on one page? And then how much do you make a digital copy of it? If you're working digitally, what size is your usual starting point? This is a fantastic question. It's kind of a 101 question, but frankly, Brad, I bet I will learn from you and you'll learn from me based on how we do it. So why don't you jump in first on this one? So what size, Brad, do you normally draw at? I know you draw digitally, both dimension-wise and resolution-wise. What sizes do you draw at?
Well, I'm so glad you said that, because size, especially in today's day and age, means so many different things. So when I was working analog, when I was working ink on paper, I would always work at about twice as big as it was going to appear in print. And the reason I did that was because when you shrink that down, a lot of the natural quivers and imperfections in your line disappear. And that line work tightens up and looks really sharp. And it's a great cheat that has been handed down from time immemorial, is that if you want your line work to look really super sharp, work about twice as big, at least, I would say at least 75% bigger, but twice as big is a nice little rule of thumb. And then when you shrink it down, your lines are going to look so sharp. When I started working digitally, I did the same thing. What are your thoughts?
Well, no, I was going to pause you for 1 second just to mention Al Hirschfeld. And for those outside of America, you may not be familiar with Al Hirschfeld's work. His work was huge from mid-century to, I guess, the 90s in the New York theater world. And he's an amazing caricaturist. But to illustrate Brad's point, Hirschfeld would draw probably 3 to 4 times the size of his reproduction size, right? So if the comic was going to appear on a poster or appear on a pamphlet, and the pamphlet was going to be, 6 inches wide, he would draw his caricatures gigantic, 20, 30 inches wide kind of a thing. And also what was interesting is Hirschfeld, when it's reproduced, looks like he's drawing with one fluid, almost vector line. But when you look at his originals up close, and my friend, via my wife's show, Rita Moreno, she has two of his in her dressing room. Mm. And you look at them up close, and it's made up of thousands of little lines
really?
To reproduce the idea of one big flowing line.
Wow.
And so that underlines Brad's point that you draw bigger so that when you reproduce, all the small mistakes, details, quivers go away, and it looks like one big flowing line.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't mean to stop you there, Brad, but I thought that was a good way to illustrate that.
Well, no, the only thing I was going to add was that when I moved to digital, I continued to do that. I continued to draw large and shrink down. And then that carried over into resolution. And that's the other meaning of the word size. I always, when I would work in ink, I would scan in at 600 DPI or PPI, that the two terms are interchangeable. I would scan it in at 600 PPI. When I work digitally, these days I'm working on an entire comic page at once. And working at 600 PPI was a little bit large in terms of the amount of bytes that it would take to comprise this file. The file size was too big. So I backed it off to 400 PPI, which stands for pixels per inch. And that is about as low as I would go for my original art. And the reason you do that is that because at some point you might want to enlarge the art or use just a piece of it a little bit bigger, and you can always reduce the resolution and increase the actual size without mm-hmm. sacrificing image quality. What you can't do is take something that is, for example, scanned in or drawn at 72 DPI, which we consider to be low res for screens only, and enlarge it or try to get more resolution out of it than is there. Like, for example, some people try to bump it up to 200, and that's when you see these big chewy pixels and a blurry line and stuff like that. You can always size down with resolution. You can't size up, okay? So that's my rule of thumb. I won't go any lower than 400 resolution for my original art. And that's knowing that in many cases, when I'm doing the final image for print, I might bump that down to 300 for the final color version, but never below 300 DPI for my resolution.
No, I think that's great. And I think the good rule of thumb that you started with was the 2 times the size. So I have a great couple examples here to build off of Brad's points, because for me, Sheldon is still drawn analog. It's still ink on paper. And Drive, my other comic, is drawn digitally. And so I'll talk you through real quick the basic sizes of them. So Sheldon, roughly, when you perceive it on a website, roughly runs in the 5 to 7 inch wide range, right?
Mm-hmm.
Depending on if you're on a laptop or you're on a big screen. And so for me, these are the exact dimensions of a Sheldon. They're 14 inches wide by 5.5 inches tall. And not 5.5 inches, by 5 inches tall. And that translates into roughly on screen about a 6-7 inch comic, right? And that's also true for newspapers, although I think newspapers can run them as small as 4. Why am I even talking about newspapers? Who cares about newspapers? but basically, to Brad's point, it's roughly about twice the size of what the comic is. When I scan it in the case of Sheldon, I scan in the original art at 600 DPI because the black and white is going to be messed with a lot. And then I tend to color it at 300 DPI for reasons that Brad could probably explain later on. What's nice about that, though, is that if I ever need to make a poster out of a Sheldon original art, I can absolutely do that. It's it's very easy-able. It's very easy to bring it up in size and then reduce the line art DPI and you have a workable size. Now for Drive, those comics, Mike Page is a non-standard comic page, like a standard Marvel is, I don't remember the ratio, but Marvel or DC comic. But mine is a non-standard page. It's meant to fit an 8.5 by 9 page. And I draw those at 400 DPI at almost double size inch wise. So I think they're drawn about 14 by 15 inches, roughly, something like that. And the reason I did that is, A, like Brad said, I wanted to be able to have extra detail that I could basically smooth out when it's reduced in size to print on a book. And then also, if I'm being honest about it, there's this quiet, tiny little hope that at some point when I'm done with Drive, I might do a supersize edition where there's a book that's like 12 inches wide instead of 9 inches wide.
Oh, yeah, like those artist edition books that that Marvel puts out sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it might be... Exactly, that's exactly the way I was thinking about it. So will I ever do it? Probably not. But the good news is, like Brad said, when you have more detail, when you have more data in your comic, you always have the option of going down. You never have the option of going up.
Right.
So I figured I might as well draw it at 400 DPI and at 14 inches wide, because really I'm only taking up a tiny bit more of my computer space when it's all said and done, even after a couple decades of work on it. But I've afforded myself the opportunity to go bigger on some future publishing than if I had kept it all drawn at size and at 300 DPI. So I think that answers her question. Do you think we nailed that one, or anything else we should add on to that one?
The general rule there is go big. Go big, and you can always make it smaller. You can never make it bigger. So your original art should be as big as you can comfortably make it. And that goes for the size of the original in real life, the physical size, and the file size, the resolution.
That's right. That's right. And then if you're going to be working digitally, the thing, and Brad talked about this on a previous show, is just always be careful about putting too much detail into a zoomed in aspect of your screen that will reproduce as a smudge. So imagine, like, in the background, you've got a Ming vase in your comic. Don't zoom in so much and add so many florets and flower details that when you actually go to print it or reproduce it onto a website, that it just becomes one little ink block. Because what you'll be able to see on your screen at 600 DPI zoomed in is very different than what your readers will see on their screen. So just be conscious of that.
Yep. Yeah, I think that says it all.
Well, Bradley J. Geiger of Philadelphia, PA, as we as an audience wish you well on your trip home to Michigan to bring that not suitable for work comic to Uncle Elmer.
I'm excited. Here's the problem is that you know that I really hate backing down from a challenge. So now it's going to be on my mind until I make it up there in August.
This is like, I've like found your super weakness. It's like in Back to the Future when somebody calls you chicken. You can't not do it.
Yeah. If you would have double dog dared me, it would have been on.
Yeah, that's right. No, I'm not going to. He would throw a cow at you. I don't want Uncle Elmer to.
He would have a cow.
Yeah, he would literally have a cow. That's right.
Yes.
Well, on that note, Brad, why don't you take us out, my friend?
All right. That guitar you hear in the background tells you you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Uncle Elmer and his dairy farm, and also Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.